particular cases, where defendants, because of such horrendous records or extremely aggravated facts, deserve more than the highest number of months that are calculated under the matrix. And at least we have now, with the system we have, the authority to set a minimum that might be beyond the range, and the safety at the other end is the fact that the parole board, if four out of the five agree, they can override it. So we do have a system now that allows the judge to exercise discretion. But in situations where it's appropriate, the parole board override it. I think the system we have now for imposing minimums with an override by the parole board in appropriate cases is a good system. It does allow the judge to use discretion in those cases that are extremely aggravated. With the bill as it's drafted now, we would lose that. There's simply little purpose, if this bill passes with Section 8 in it, of a judge setting a minimum sentence. We ordinarily reserve those minimum sentences for cases where we look at the PSI and see what the range is and say that's entirely inappropriate given this case. And so, because of the aggravated nature of the offense or the extremely aggravated history, record of convictions of the defendant, it's just extremely inappropriate, we set a minimum sentence. If we felt that the sentence that was dictated by the matrix was an appropriate sentence, there's no need to set a minimum sentence. If in looking at the history involved and the offense is deemed that this is an aggravated situation that deserves a longer period of imprisonment, then we impose a minimum. So if the bill passed, frankly, I think that few judges would impose minimum sentences. Nothing would be gained by it.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Section 10, beginning on the bottom of page 7, deals with consecutive sentences. And I understand the necessity of trying to legislate some standards or some authority for consecutive sentences. I think Judge Hargreaves and I, in comparing our notes, are both troubled somewhat by the language that's used, though. And I'm not going to refer to all the... I've taken more time probably than I should here already, but there's the language on 18, not merely incidental to a violation. In line 24, qualitatively different loss. Turning over to page 9, line 3, the court shall not impose a consecutive sentence unless the court finds that the period of imprisonment would not be commensurate with the seriousness of the total course of the defendant's criminal conduct. And although those are things that we take into account now, by legislating it, I frankly feel, and apparently Bill Gary disagrees with me, but we're opening up a whole new can of worms as to what in fact those terms mean. They're not terms ordinarily used in the law. I deem them more as, for lack of a better term, sociological type terms, not legal terms. And it would seem to me subject the sentencing process to more and new litigation in order to try to define what terms like commensurate with the seriousness of the total course of the defendant's criminal conduct, qualitatively different loss, not merely incidental to a violation. It's a whole new hotbed of litigation there for defense attorneys. They'd love it, I think. Not faulting them, but those terms are such a question, and probably without, well, in this statute as drafted, without definition. I'm referring now to page 10, section 13, dealing with community service work. I made reference to this at our luncheon meeting the other day. Frankly, I don't think much is gained by setting minimum terms or minimum periods of community service work for various types of violations. In some cases, even for a felony, it's impossible for a person to perform 80 hours of community service work. I think it's good legislative policy to set the maximum sentences. And in that regard, set maximum periods of community service work to be served, but frankly, the minimum ought to be left to the discretion of the court, given the particular defendant the offense has been committed, that person's ability to perform community service work, those sorts of things, and other penalties that might be imposed. We frankly impose in some cases only community service work where a person cannot be incarcerated and has no ability to pay a fine. That's one situation. In other situations, it may be a mix where the person is required to serve a period of incarceration, pay a fine, and perform some community service work. And so even for the same offense, it may vary from defendant to defendant, that being the appropriate amount of community service to be performed.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Scavero.
Could you give me an example or a couple of very short examples of felonies that persons would do community service for, that 80 hours of community service work would not be appropriate?
I think the last one that comes to mind, Representative Scavero, that I had was a mother. I don't recall exactly the charge. It was fraudulent use of food stamps or welfare fraud, something like that, with five children, no prior offense. Apparently did it feeling that it was necessary in order to support a family, who I did order to pay restitution for what it was worth, apparently little ability to pay. Was not going to incarcerate her because of the fact that she had the young children, and she had no car, no transportation, and I felt that it was virtually impossible that she was ever going to perform 80 hours of community service work. So I didn't order. I ordered a lesser amount.
Of community service?
Yes. Young children, unable to be away from them, preschool children, that sort of thing.
But you still felt that some community service work was appropriate?
Yes, I did. That's correct.
Okay.
I'm just saying that, frankly, we do impose substantial hours of community service work in lots of cases, but there are those situations where it's just unrealistic, and that's one of them I've just described to you. And as it stands now, we're limited. Frankly, the district attorney in my county will call to my attention if I indicate that I'm imposing something less than the minimum. I have on occasion said that I thought that something less was appropriate, and so I'm doing it anyway, and they don't really argue all that much. But again, it would seem to me that the court ought to have the discretion of setting any amount of community service work for particular offenses up to a maximum limit, but leave it to the discretion of the judge to decide just exactly what that amount of community service should be.
Thank you.
I'm going to skip over something, sir. I'm going to defer to Judge Hargreaves on some of the other matters that I was going to comment on. One last comment, though, and that is that it may just be an oversight. I know this was the first draft of the bill. Referring now to page 12, section 17, beginning on line 14, there you see it sets forth what the new board will consider in determining an appropriate release date. And it refers to a number of things, as you see there. And I did not see included there any reference to the findings, which under this bill as drafted would be required of circuit court judges on page 2 that I referred to initially. Page 2, section 3, requires the court to make findings. The court shall make findings as it determines it will assist the board of prison terms, et cetera. It would seem to me that if you intend to adopt this concept, that included within that ought to be those findings, that the parole board should consider those findings as well as the other information that's been set forth there. That really concludes my comments. If you have any additional questions, I'd be glad to try to handle them. Otherwise, I'll have simply Judge Hargreaves indicate to you his feelings on a number of these provisions.
All right, let's take Judge Hargreaves' testimony. You might remain there if you would.
I'll be here at additional sessions.
Do you have time, Robin? Can you stay on for a few
minutes? No, I can continue.
Let's take Judge Hargreaves' testimony, then we can see if there are questions that might be directed to either one or both of them.
All right, thank you. I am Jim Hargreaves from Lane County Circuit Court. Judge Bonebrick's covered a number of things, and he and I conferred somewhat on this and are in agreement on a number of things. Couple of items that I think I would want to address. One thing on page 9 in subparagraph 6 of section 10. And this I guess this comment goes really to a number of the places where we talk about the court making various findings and putting those into the sentencing order. I have concerns, first of all, that it's not clear to me what it is that we're seeking through this. If what you're after is to make sure the judge makes the findings, that's one thing, and that's on, of course, in the court record, and I'm sure the defendant's going to raise that on appeal if he thinks you haven't made the appropriate findings when you gave him his sentence. If it's for the purpose, some purpose of the parole board, then I think we get to what I consider to be one of the base problems that we have here, and that's the continuing blurring of this line between the parole board and the courts, the judicial and the executive branch. As Judge Bonebreak alluded to a little earlier when he was talking about clear back in section 4, I guess it was, that if we're being required to make certain findings because they currently fit into some scheme that the parole board has of making its matrix operate, then two questions seem to me to arise. First and most obvious, I guess, is when they change some one of those criteria so they need some new or different finding, I don't think constitutionally you can let the parole board wag the court system and say every time that we change our findings that we need, Judge, you're going to have to make new findings. And you're going to have to do that, however, if you're going to leave the language open so that the court is making whatever findings the parole board needs. I don't think you can do that. And if you're not, if you're going to set specific findings that we have to make with the hope that those will then continue to fit into the parole board system, if they don't, we're making some findings that are not necessary and other finding and not making some findings that are, and there's nothing to control the time or circumstances under which the parole board may change the criteria that they may be using and the standards they may set and the things that they're looking at. Finally, I guess to me, one of the more important things is that it just doesn't fit my concept of what a sentence order ought to be, that we are putting in what may turn out to be long narrative statements of reasons that a sentence is given and various findings of fact was what you're really asking for here. It seems to me a sentence order ought to say that the defendant was charged with this offense, he was convicted of this offense, and he's been sentenced to this long. And any findings that may be required ought to appear in the court record and be preserved in that record and ought not to be set out in the sentencing order. For instance, I'm sure that the defense bar would be quite unhappy to have a defendant come to trial to be impeached with a prior conviction where I set out all the findings about him being a dangerous offender and set out all my reasons in the sentence order for the sentence that I gave to him, outlining his long criminal history and the nasty things that he did to various individuals, only to have that certified and handed up to the court as an exhibit when the defendant is called to testify and he is impeached. That's just one example that comes to mind immediately. Just seems to me to be a real inappropriate thing to do in a sentence order. Besides the other problems I see of asking the court to do essentially what is the parole board's function, if they're going to make determinations of when people should get out and we're only going to make the in and out decision, then it seems to me they ought to have their own system for gathering whatever data they want to have and making their own decisions on that data about how long they're going to keep people. It seems to me that we need to draw that line between the court system and the parole board, and it needs to be drawn rather clearly. Let's see. Section 12, subsection 2, at line 21, that's on page 9, when we're talking about how many sentences you can give and trying to define here what's a separate offense. You've used the term joint interest, My only comment there is I have some concerns with the use of that sort of term in that whether we're going to start litigating then within the criminal context the various real and personal property issues that have been litigated for about 200 or 300 years in the court system, what a joint interest means and what's the state going to plead and what are they going to have to prove in these various cases to produce separate sentences on these. I just have some concern that that's a piece of language that's still too loose and that's going to cause some difficulties. Also, excuse me, in subparagraph 3 on page 10 of that same section where we talk at line 12, excuse me, or starting on line 11, it says to be separately punishable under this subsection must be separated from other violations by a sufficient pause in the defendant's criminal conduct to afford the defendant an opportunity to renounce the criminal intent. Who's going to decide that?
Judge, let me ask you to hold that point for a minute. We'll come back and start with that point. We are requested to be on the floor briefly to answer the roll quorum purposes, and then we will be right back. So those of you who are here, if you can hang around, we should be back momentarily. We'll be in recess for about 5 minutes.
I need my automatic yes.
I want to apologize to all of you in advance for what may be recurring interruptions. We don't know. They're close to losing a quorum on the floor with us gone. They've one vote to spare. Someone chickens out. Besides, they've had enough and resign or whatever. We're in a problem. Or if there's a call to the House, we'll have to go down. If I may, I'd like to go back just momentarily to 2645, which I think is now ready for committee action. We'll get that out of the way and then return to the sentencing bill.
This is
2645.
This revised version is the work of Representative Scavero and Smith that would take out the section 2 would have been a cross-reference to the false swearing statute. That would be handled instead by what is on the last page, which is simply adding, right now when you file a claim for a lien, you have to verify the lien by oath. Right now, if you knowingly lie in verifying it, that is false swearing. This change would simply add to the end of the sentence in the construction lien laws that say you must verify by oath a phrase subject to the criminal penalties provided under 162.075, which is the false swearing statute. So it doesn't create anything new. It just tells someone who is about to file a construction lien that when they verify it under oath, they are under the purview of the existing false swearing law.
It's issue number one.
So that's that one. The section 3 of the Dash 5 amended bill is taken out. That would have created a new private right of action, a civil action for a false lien, and I think there were enough worries about how it would actually be used and whether it didn't have too broad a sweep. That was taken out, but the changes made in section 4 in large part will answer that problem. In section 4 at line, 10, where there's a star beside it in the column, the word rebuttable was to be put in, and that's to make it clear that this language was to put in so that basically the person claiming a lien doesn't have to bring in somebody else to say yes, indeed those were reasonable charges to make. Rather, you can, a builder under this can come in and say, this is what I paid for this, this is what my hours were on that, and my sub's hours. That would be the prima facie case. It could be rebutted then by the other side saying, no, that's an unreasonable, picking a particular item and saying that's an unreasonable amount to charge. But, and at that point, it would shift the burden back and forth rather than in every case having to bring in someone who is virtually an expert witness and as part of the plaintiff's prima facie case having to go through every item of expenditure and say, yes, that was reasonable. This would let you take the plaintiff's testimony initially to establish a rebuttable presumption, which it was our understanding is how it works in just about every other civil lawsuit that plaintiff gets to say my car, which you hit, was worth so much, you know, I just bought it. People can testify to the value of their property generally. And so this is essentially meant to conform to that. And the last change on the last page of the printed amendment, still in section 4, would delete this had contained two parts. It said it continues the existing requirement that the court shall award attorney's fees to the prevailing party on a lien for on the foreclosure and validity of the lien. As I mentioned, the recent case had said yes, but it would then go on to give the builder some money under quantum merit. That builder is the prevailing party, not the homeowner, and therefore we give the attorney's fees to the builder, or at least we don't give them to the homeowner who got the lien disallowed. This would clarify it to say that if the lien is disallowed, the party who prevailed on that issue, the property owner, will get attorney's fees. And quite likely that would include attorney's fees spent or incurred in preparation of the quantum merit part of the lawsuit, but it was the de facto task force's feeling that that was the way to discourage invalid liens, make it clear that up to the day of trial, if you discover you've got an invalid lien, you better drop your lien claim and just proceed on quantum merit, because if you continue with your lien claim into trial and lose on the lien claim, the court is going to sock you with the attorney's fees, that may cover the quantum merit part of trial preparation on the part of the property owner. So this is intended to really discourage anybody from taking a phony lien that they know is phony all the way to trial. So those were the changes. There's an additional change that's really minor. The words, however, attorney's fees may be denied, as provided in two cross-references in the construction lien statutes. That's in present law. It's not a complete list of other places in the lien statutes that say that a builder loses attorney's fees if he or she does something wrong. And Joe Barkowski and Legislative Council agreed that it wasn't needed, and it is potentially inaccurate here because there are other places where attorney's fees are denied to the lien claimant if you screwed up in some other state, even though your lien's valid, but you did something wrong in some other stage of the process. So he agreed that could be taken out without changing the law, and probably with clarifying and getting rid of the confusing cross-references.
Okay, thank you for your efforts clarifying the bill. Representative Smith, do you wish to move the bill?
Move the amendments.
Move the amendments. Is there any further discussion of the amendments? Is there objection?
Be helpful. It sounds like, I don't know either of these two gentlemen, I assume we both have, you do lien foreclosures in your courtroom.
Yes.
Could I clarify just the third point with them and make sure that we haven't missed something? The Oregon Court of Appeals has apparently ruled that you are to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party in a lien foreclosure case, and they've interpreted that to mean that even though you disallowed the lien because it was technically wrong, if the contractor prevails on his quantum merit claim, some judges are then compelled to give attorney's fees to the contractor. Our thinking is that a lien being an extraordinary remedy in the first place, creating a cloud on title that ought to be dispensed with at the earliest possible time, that the attorney's fees ought to be allowed at the time that the court determines that the lien is allowed or disallowed. Then if the lien is disallowed because it's technically incorrect, the contractor can choose to proceed on a breach of contract theory or quantum merit theory, whatever, but he's doing it at his own expense because his lien no longer carries attorney's fees with it, unless he has a written contract that maybe gives him attorney's fees. So what we're really asking by this change is that you as judges determine the award of attorney's fees on the failure or success of the foreclosure of the lien itself. If the lien is foreclosed, you will proceed to award the contractor all the reasonable attendant attorney's fees for getting his case to that point, and probably in determining what his lien is worth, you've done everything. If the homeowner or the owner of the property prevails and defeats the lien, they are going to get awarded attorney's fees for defeating that lien right then and there, even though in the following action, quantum merit award goes to the contractor. But it is the moment in time when you make the determination that the lien has failed or succeeded and it should be and is foreclosed that you will decide that the attorney's fees, who will get them?
Your question is whether or not that's workable or whether we wish to...
We think we're clarifying what the original intent was that the Court of Appeals misinterpreted.
Well, I think that would clarify. The point that I was making, and this certainly is a policy decision for you to make, is that I
prosecuted as a private attorney lien foreclosures, which probably all of you have, and defended them, and as a judge sat and tried them. And I know that there are, I have seen a number of liens fail for because of very technical small items. Contractors are sued to foreclose on substantial amounts of money, and something non-lienable item is contained therein for a few dollars, causing the lien to fail. The contractor to then recover a substantial portion, or nearly all of what he had requested. It's true the lien failed. In that situation, as I understand it, you would have us award to the landowner, the property owner, the attorney's fees.
Right, and that puts the onus on the contractor who filed his lien and his attorney right up to the moment before you rule on the validity of the lien, that they can dismiss as to the lien and continue on quantum merit, but without attorney's fees.
That's true. I understand.
And we think we're encouraging written contracts then, which at the front end of the deal support attorney's fees and all the other transactions, which then gets you out of the problem of trying all these cases on cost plus, you know, that basis,
another
which is very long and tedious.
Might be with that sort of hammer to encourage more settlements. Also.
That's our other purpose in this. Any real problem with it?
I have none.
No, I don't think so. I guess I have some of the same concerns that Judge Bonebrake does, but you know, if your thought is to encourage the early disposition of the lien and to try and encourage settlements, I think that probably will happen. I would be a little bit surprised if you end up causing a substantial increase in the number of people who are operating on written contracts and who reduce things to writing who don't now. My experience has been that I grew up in a family of contractors, all my uncles and my grandfather, and you know, they were just as dumb as the rest of them. They used to wander in there with a piece of paper in one hand and a pencil in the other and jot a few things down, and they shake hands on this and make a few changes on that, and they get all done and total up the end result. And that's what you mostly, you know, you see so often. And then the contractor will not spend the 50 or 100 bucks to go into a lawyer, go over the thing carefully before he files his lien. He goes down and gets a Stevenson S form and scribbles it out. And I doubt that you're going to encourage much change in that.
I think it's worth, for our record, one more question that is raised by Mr. Hall. If the lien is disallowed, and you've awarded them a rather substantial amount of attorney's fees to the landowner, but underneath that is a breach of contract, and there is a written contract providing for prevailing party attorney's fees, and at the end of the case, the quantum merit case under the contract goes to the builder, how do you wash the two attorney's fees out as against each other?
That's not my problem, that's your problem.
When we get through here, it's going to be yours.
Well, I realize that, and I couldn't begin to comment. I don't know. It's sort of like you pull a thread over here and something puckers over there. I don't know the answer to that. I really don't.
It's a good question.
I can, if this is passed the House, I can alert the Senate committee that that issue should be looked at.
You trust them?
Would we be achieving close to our policy if we, and clarification of the Court of Appeals decision, if we gave the court simply the authority to do this. The court may allow a reasonable amount of attorney's fees at trial and on appeal the party prevails on the issues of the validity of foreclosure of the land.
Oh, please don't do that.
Don't do that.
Please don't do that. We're going to be litigating that all day. Then, you know, whether this is an appropriate case in your discretion to give attorney's fees or not give attorney's fees. You know, if you're going to do something, just make it black or white. Don't make it gray.
It's gray now. I think it's gray now.
Yeah.
This is a different shade of gray. We've done something.
All right. On that last point, I think in line with the policy that you were discussing back there, perhaps the statutory award of attorney's fees to the owner on disallowance of the lien should override a contractual provision, because the whole idea was don't file your lien and take it to court if it's an invalid lien. So I guess there really isn't a problem that this probably the statutory provision would override the contractual provision for attorney's fees, and probably should on that rationale, that if you've got an invalid lien, drop it.
Dismiss it and proceed on your contract when you're awarded attorney's fees. So you'd be a better case. You shouldn't bring the lien in. I think we're okay.
All right.
Further discussion of the bill as amended?
Do you have a motion now on the bill? I
don't remember. Mitchell Smith moves House Bill 2645 as amended to be reported with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Good.
Chair?
Aye. Now, while we have the two of you here, we have late to other bills we'd like to ask. Would you put one of those files out?
Yes.
We have a couple of extra chairs if you'd like to sit.
Much prefer sitting down here responding, thank you.
Okay, back to the omnibus bill. Judge Hargraves?
The question that I had raised before the adjournment was on page 10 of line 12, where I was talking about the question of determining how many crimes you have committed in terms of one violation of one statute against one victim but repeated offenses, in the language it talks about affording a defendant an opportunity to renounce the criminal intent. I understand Mr. Gary has some language that he proposed to change that somewhat, but it produces the same problem. That is, right now, when we're talking about merger and we're talking about how many times a person can be convicted and sentenced for